or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today, we'll be joined by NAACP President and CEO Ben Jealous and Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul. But first, hear Jason Fornicola's interview with Congresswoman Donna Edwards.
We've been joined by one of our favorite guests here today, Congresswoman Donna Edwards, representing Maryland's 4th Congressional District. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
So we have you here again at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's annual legislative conference celebrating 40 years. Tell me a little bit about what you've done here today.
Well, it's been really great. One, meeting with a group of students, actually, from Montgomery County Public Schools who are part of an emerging leaders program, and they spent the whole day here, and so I had a chance to visit with them and hear about all the sessions that they went to. All of them went to very different sessions, and they learned from each other, and it really actually was a testament to what happens here at the conference.
So I want to piggyback off that just a little bit and get your thoughts on the issue of education, where we are and where we need to be heading into the future.
Well, I think when I think about education, I think about these young people. I say, you know what, we actually have to make investments and enable them, if they choose to go to college, to get a trade, to be productive in the workforce. And that requires us to have highly qualified teachers who are in our classrooms. It requires us to have classrooms that are actually small enough so that young people can actually learn in them. And I think it's going to require us to make deeper investments, even in the infrastructure of our schools, the right kinds of laboratories for experiments, the right kind of technology so that they're trained on the technology for the future.
And what do you think it's going to take to get there? What improvements, what can we do tangibly? What can you do in Congress to make sure that these things that we need are actually delivered on?
Well, some of these things are about being very precise about the needs of individual schools and school districts and working with our superintendents and our leadership in the states so that we can really identify and be very precise about targeting resources and the kind of resources that are really needed in schools. Not all of our schools need the same things. Not all of our school systems from one state to the next state need the same thing. They all need highly qualified teachers, though.
We recently had on a representative from the National Education Association, and they were talking about a summit they had on community and parental engagement in the development of a child in his or her education. Talk a little bit about how important it is to educate a child, not only in the classroom, but outside of the classroom, in life, getting people on board to really develop the child.
Well, obviously, you've hit on it. We need whole children. And in order to do that, it means that our entire community has to be invested in that. You know, I don't have a child in school anymore, but that doesn't mean I don't have a responsibility in our schools. And I think around our communities, our seniors have a lot to contribute to our children. Some of the best schools that I've seen actually engage some of our seniors in the classroom assisting our educators, parents who are really involved in their children's education. But we also have to have an employment environment that enables parents to be involved in their children's education, flexible enough so that parents can go to parent-teacher meetings, so that they can be present in schools. And when parents are present in a school, you can tell the difference in that school. You can tell the difference in the children.
I want to shift gears for just a minute and get your thoughts on the economy. You know, still feeling like we're struggling a little bit. People are still out of work. Where are we going with this? And when are we going to feel like, as a country, we are back to where we need to be?
Well, what I do know is that we're on the right track. I mean, if we had had this conversation a year and a half ago, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month, and now we're creating jobs. And we're not where we need to be, but we know that we're on the right track. I had a job fair out in my congressional district just 2 weeks ago, 2,685 people looking for jobs, about 75 employers hiring, but not enough hiring going on. I actually agree with the president that we have to make deeper investments in things like research and development tax credits. I think that we have to have incentives that co-locate those tax credits with incentives for local manufacturing. I have visited over the course of the last month three really amazing employers in my district who are doing research, technology, and they're doing manufacturing all in one place. Those are the kind of workplaces we need across the country.
Yeah, and talk about the need really to invest in our country's infrastructure to make sure that our roads and bridges and tunnels and whatnot are safe and that we're really modernizing our infrastructure to compete globally.
Well, not only is an investment in infrastructure a short-term payoff because people get put to work right away, but it's a long-term payoff as well, because when you invest in your infrastructure, you're investing in the future. Our roads, all of our infrastructure, roads, water, sewer, you name it, it's falling apart. And we're falling behind. And so I think in order to compete globally, we have to make those investments in infrastructure. And it's about building roads, repairing bridges, you know, developing that high-speed rail, making sure that our freight rail operates the way that it needs to, investing in mass transportation so that we can get people from point A to point B and create the kinds of efficiencies that we need in order to be able to compete.
I want to ask you a question about the economy. Obviously, we've gone through a really tough time. I want to know if you think that we'll ever, if the economy in the future will ever look like it did in the past. You know, we're told now, you know, we need to save a little bit more. We need to make sure that we have some safety nets and whatnot. But so much of our economy has always seemed to be based off of consumer spending. So how do we continue to move the economy forward, but make sure that people are saving enough at the same time and taking care of that part of their lives?
Well, I have to say, I'm one of those who doesn't believe that we should have an economy that looks like the one that we had, because the one that we had was actually a false economy. It was one in which a handful of people were making a boatload of money off of all the rest of us. And so it really actually was not real. And so I want to see us build an economy that works for working people, that works for working families, that encourages us to save, but also enables us to own homes and prepare for our retirement. And you do that very deliberately. And that means that we can't spend everything that we have. But it also means that we can't provide as taxpayers tax cuts only for the wealthiest Americans without investing in the middle class.
Well, that was my next topic that I wanted to talk to you about. And that really is the issue of tax cuts in this country seem to bubble right to the top. And it's a hot button issue. Where do you stand on tax cuts and who gets them and who doesn't and whatnot?
Well, for me, it's a no-brainer. If you are in the top 2% of income earners, then the other 98% of us need tax cuts. And it's really just that simple. And what we're talking about in this economy is taxpayers who are making under $300,000 or $250,000 a year. That is 98% of Americans. And so the 2% need to pay their fair share. And the reality is that those tax cuts, we're all only talking about restoring what was in place before we had the tax cuts, and we're talking about making sure that you don't just give away almost $700 billion in unfunded tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans. I think that this is really simple. I think that for the people who live in my congressional district, who live in most of our congressional districts, this is a no-brainer. Tax cuts for working people making under $300,000 to $250,000 a year, and all the rest of them, you have to pay your fair share.
Now, you have been a champion of federal employees for quite a while. And we've had these conversations before, but I want to get your take again on how important it really is for transportation security officers to have the same rights that all other federal employees have in terms of collective bargaining.
Well, I tell you, it is actually shocking that we've actually segregated the federal workforce by allowing some to be represented and others not to be. And I think that what we've seen in the TSA, the Transportation Administration, is that we could actually have a higher caliber workforce, a better trained workforce, a better prepared workforce if it is represented through collective bargaining. And so I want to see us make sure that we get to that point.
And some opponents may say that there's some sort of national security issue associated with workers having protections in the workplace, collective bargaining rights and whatnot. How do you respond to those criticisms?
I think that's just an excuse for people who don't believe in workers' rights and collective bargaining. I happen to believe that whether you're talking about the private sector or the public sector, your best employees, your best workforce is going to be one that's organized and where they have the ability to communicate with management in a way that's respectful of workers.
And going forward for you, what do you have coming up in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, you know, we have an election coming up in November, and I have finished my primary election, and I have a real obligation to make sure that I believe that we ought to maintain this Democratic leadership in the Congress for working people and for the middle class. And I feel so strongly about that. All you hear some of the other guys talk about is going back to what didn't work for the middle class. I'm not prepared to go backwards.
You're moving forward.
Moving forward.
Congresswoman Donna Edwards, always a pleasure to have you on the program. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Ben Jealous, President and CEO of the NAACP. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you, thank you. It's great to be here.
So you guys have, along with labor, I guess, the upcoming One Nation March that the NAACP is participating in here in Washington. Tell us about the march and how the idea began.
Sure. Yeah, this is labor and civil rights and faith communities, immigrants' rights communities, all coming together to stand up, say it's time to make job creation job one in this country. It's time to make sure that our public schools get the funding they deserve and that we solve some of the big work-related justice issues that continue to plague us, like a broken system of migration laws and our the ongoing plague of racial profiling. But at the heart of this, and the big number one, is job creation. The way it started really rose out of the experience of the healthcare debate. And we, healthcare had been announced DOA, and we all came running back to help revive it, and we succeeded. And it affirmed for us that when we work together, we can make big things happen. When we stand separately, we can see dreams disintegrate before us. The experience, you know, the other part of that experience was all the hatred that we heard on the radio and on TV, the hateful signs, in the sense that in this moment of increasing, that we were living through a very particular moment in history, a moment of increasing diversity amidst decreasing prosperity. And that that type of moment presents you with two choices. You can do what so many others have done, so many who have kind of been said so many hateful things on the radio and TV and at rallies and focus on attacking and pushing down diversity. You know, this is folks who, you know, muse about reopening debate on the Civil Rights Act, who attempt to reopen debate on the 14th Amendment, and who have succeeded in making racial profiling the law in Arizona and trying to do that now in states across the country. So you can go that route when diversity is increasing and prosperity is decreasing. You can attack diversity, try to push it down. The other alternative, what we're trying to do here, is you can push up on prosperity. You can say, you know, we realize that these times are a formula for a battleground, but we know that with hard work and people coming together and conscious social movement, we can flip that into common ground. And so that's what we're focused on, is seeking common ground by pushing up on prosperity.
And where will the march be held?
The march will be at the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C., on October 2nd, it'll begin with a multi-faith service at 11, and then the formal rally will begin at noon.
And what kinds of things, what kinds of speakers will be at the rally?
You'll see speakers from civil rights, from labor, from the faith community, from the immigrants' rights community, peace community, all together, you know, talking about the need for our country to move towards common ground, to focus on job creation, you know, really affirming that, you know, the country that we want to build most right now, all of us, is our own, and that we need to be focused on things that create jobs at home, that strengthen our public schools so the workers of tomorrow have every advantage, and that move us beyond these issues that keep us divided.
And you mentioned, I mean, there's been a lot on the airwaves, as you mentioned, about sort of hate-oriented speech and people taking real extremist views. I mean, this sounds like a march really to bring people together and to move forward and not backward. Would that be fair?
That's exactly right. You know, we say, look, you know, it is time to pull our country back together, and the way to do that is to put it back to work. We have come too far in the last 2 years, you know, whether it's expanding rights for women at work, rights protection by passing the Lilly Ledbetter bill, whether it's, extending health care, putting health care within reach of tens of millions of our neighbors who couldn't afford it, whether it's addressing some of the big criminal justice disparities. There's been major advancements, and right now in this moment, if people don't stand up, if they don't let their voice be heard, if they don't seek to dramatically impact the public discourse, all of that could disintegrate.
And you mentioned one of the big themes is going to be jobs. And let's talk about some of the best ways to get people working again. I mean, a lot of people were critical of the stimulus bills and things like that. But, of course, if you didn't have that money, there'd be layoffs of teachers, layoffs of police officers at the state and local level. I mean, on some level, you got to preserve the jobs that you have and to increase those jobs. What are some of the issues around jobs that you're going to be looking at the rally, and what kind of outcomes are you looking for?
Yeah, we're looking for, you know, we believe that the values that got us out of the Great Depression will get us out of the Great Recession. That this country's got to pay for this recession in cash, one way or the other. We can pay for, with, you know, increasing incarceration rates, increasing unemployment benefits, increasing foster care for broken families, or we can invest in creating good jobs, and we can, you know, do what we did in this country with the WPA. We can hold families together by putting them back to work. We can invest, in other words, in what we want to be and not what we fear becoming. And you know, that's what we're saying. You know, you look, how do we do that? There's a bill right now called the George Miller Bill. It's stuck in the House because of the backlog of bills in the Senate. You know, people, you know, wonder whether or not it could actually get through. It would create 1 million jobs right away. There's the Ted Kennedy Service Act, bipartisan support, would create a 250,000, you know, fully funding it, would create a 250,000 jobs for young people who are experiencing incredible unemployment rates right now. But it's held up because the Senate refuses to appropriate the dollars, despite that bipartisan support. And that's, you know, we just got to get back to, you know, basic economics. We've got to get back to, you know, strategies that have worked. We've got to get back to the American way, which is that in hard times, we come together and we make job creation job one.
And let's talk about the issue of education. How do you think we're doing as a country on education, and what can we do to improve our educational system?
One is, right now we need to just invest in shoring it up. Teachers are losing jobs left and right. The town that I lived in last before I moved back to D.C. to help lead the NAACP shutting down 6 out of 10 public schools as we speak. This was a town that was known for its great public school system. We really need to be focused on policies that work. The countries that lead the world and the states that lead this country and the counties that lead our states all do 4 things. They extend their school days and their school years, get past the agrarian model that's truly outdated. They invest in universal pre-K and really invest in making sure that kids the support they need to learn how to read as soon as they're ready. They invest in teacher training, and they focus. We're like the one major country that doesn't do this last bit. They focus resources on the kids who are most in need. We often give the least resources to the kids who are most in need in our public system and the most to the kids who have the most advantages in life, and that's because of our localized system of funding and because we've refused to modernize it in significant ways for at least 100 years. So those 4 things are what, you know, we at the NAACP push, and we push them because they're what works.
And as we talk about education, let's also talk for a minute about teachers. And how do we recruit and retain the best teachers? I mean, I know the philosophy now seems to be we test students, but what do we do to make sure we actually have good teachers beyond simply testing everybody all the time?
One thing is that we, you know, I would say two things. One, we really have to invest more in building a movement of young people going in to teach, really instilling them with a sense of mission, making heroes out of teachers in a conscious way, and promoting the profession for what it is, which is one of the most noble ways to serve your country and your community. Two, you know, we really need to support teachers. We need to make sure that salaries are competitive, but we also need to make sure that there's ongoing training, that people receive the support that they need early in their career to really feel confident and in control of their classroom as quickly as possible. And, you know, finally, we really need to invest in making sure every school is a great school. Although a lot of times teachers leave the profession simply because they don't feel like they get the support they need. They feel like they're kind of left out there all alone on the front line in a school that is, you know, for all intents and purposes, financially bankrupt, and in a school system that you know, doesn't have the power it needs to really take care of all of its children. And there's nothing, you know, I think a lot of us make sort of, well, 80% of the kids, well, 90%, well, look, when you're a teacher, you want 100% of your kids to succeed. And if you feel like society is essentially sending the message that 30% of them don't count, it's a very painful thing to have to look kids in the eyes every day knowing that their town, their city, their state, their country isn't prepared to support their proper education.
And as we move back and talk a little about the march, I mean, there recently was a march there at the Lincoln Memorial that Glenn Beck and some of the people on the extreme right did. How do you see this march in comparison to that?
So, you know, they've made their choice and we've made ours. This moment of increasing diversity and decreasing prosperity, they've chosen to attack diversity. And they've chosen, quite frankly, to push a very narrow, exclusive, divisive theology. What you'll see at this march is, you know, all faith traditions really honored and respected, represented. You know, the major ones certainly in the Abrahamic tradition will all be, you know, actually represented. And you'll see a politics that says, you know, divided we fall, united we prosper. Let's focus on increasing prosperity in this country. Let's focus on putting this country back to work so we can pull it back together. You know, let's recognize that we are one nation, truly one nation, and let's act like it. Let's come to the aid of our neighbors and make sure that this country is firmly, you know, on a track. You know, they say take our country back. We say take our country back to being number one. And that's what we're doing in this country right now. And we just got to keep on pushing ahead. We've come too far to let ourselves be turned back by people who want to divide us and turn us against each other.
And, you know, for a long time, I know a lot of us have gotten, you know, really reprehensible emails from people. I mean, even family and friends, things that, as you mentioned, have been on the airwaves, things that have been in print. Do you think that this is going to be a reaffirmation for folks that, hey, we really are one country, and let's stop talking about, you know, one small group over here and one small group over there and being divisive? The whole point is coming together. I mean, there are bigger issues. There's jobs that, as you mentioned, are important. Educating our kids. I mean, that isn't that really what it's all about?
That's exactly what it's about. I mean, that's what being in, you know, being a citizen of this country, a member of this country, being an American is fundamentally all about. And it's time for us to really part with the bad habits and excesses of the 20th century and before, and focus on being the nation that we want to be for our children in the 21st century and beyond.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Great to be with you.
Well, let's start off by updating everybody on the state of American manufacturing today. Where are we today?
Well, it's been probably the worst decade for American manufacturing that we've ever had, even worse than the Great Depression. We've had a lot of difficulties over the last 2.5 years with the recession, obviously. Manufacturing has sort of bottomed out. Things aren't getting worse, but they're not improving greatly. But we've suffered a lot of erosion over the last decade because of the acute factors of the collapse of the auto and the housing markets that we saw, compounded with increased globalization and a lot of competition from China. It's resulted in the loss of about 5.5 million manufacturing jobs. That's one third of our manufacturing workforce. It's led to a drop in manufacturing output for the first time in the United States over the last decade. And we're poised to lose our number one ranking in manufacturing to China next year. For the first time in 110 years, America will not be number one. So we have a lot of challenges, but I think we have some opportunities as well.
You know, a lot of people always say that one of the things America has to do is make stuff. And obviously, that's exactly what we're talking about. And that leads to tax revenues. I mean, if you're making stuff, and we were talking earlier a little about what that might mean and how that might work. Could you tell us a little about that?
Well, sure. First of all, there's no economic activity in the United States that has the multiplier effect, as economists would call it, than manufacturing. A manufacturing job supports 4 or 5 other jobs in the economy. A manufacturing job tends to pay better than jobs in the rest of the private sector. Local manufacturers tend to be the largest taxpayers. So when you combine all of that, that's a tremendous amount of economic activity. And when you lose that, what you're replacing it with generally is economic activity that is much smaller in size and significance. Now, with regard to China, and I think this is the big issue that we're confronting right now, there may be some legislation in the Congress to deal with China's currency manipulation. But the bottom line on this is that if we get China to play by the rules, it's going to increase American manufacturing jobs. We're losing about 500,000 American manufacturing jobs every year because of currency manipulation in China. If we were to reverse that, switch that around, Economic Policy Institute estimates that we would be creating a tremendous amount of economic activity in the United States. We could add about 1.4% to our GDP. And what that translates to when you run it through all these multipliers and estimators is about $500 billion in additional revenue for the federal government over the next 10 years. And the cost to taxpayers of doing that is absolutely nothing. And it's only because we're revitalizing manufacturing and we're increasing the amount of economic activity and the paychecks that are going into people's pockets.
Now, let's emphasize that number, $500 billion. That's quite a bit of change.
Well, yeah, it's like a stimulus program in a lot of ways. And it's part of this rebalancing. I mean, trade is a pretty esoteric issue to people because, you know, no one trades with another country. I mean, you buy products and they may be made in the United States. They may be made elsewhere. But it's a serious challenge for the United States because we have a big check account. And one of those big checking accounts is obviously the federal budget. The other big checking account that we have is dealing with trade. And when we have more imports coming in than exports going out, we have a trade deficit. And we've been compiling a trade deficit for a couple of decades now, but it's really been turbocharged over the last decade. And most of that trade deficit, when you take out petroleum, because we're very dependent on foreign oil. About 40% of our oil is from the Middle East, for example. But when you take that out, it's mostly manufactured goods, and it's mostly with China. And so if you're able to balance that number and balance that trade checkbook, it basically means that we're exporting more, that we're creating more goods here, and that leads to greater employment. And it would bring down the unemployment rate. I mean, I think dealing with China on currency, most estimates that economists have are that it would bring down our unemployment rate in some areas by 1.5 or 2% just in that action alone.
Well, and but let's I guess war game this out a little bit as I'm thinking this through. When we talk about currency manipulation, that's a fairly complex concept. What exactly does currency? What is the currency manipulation that the Chinese are doing?
Well, it's a you're right. It is it's a complex set of maneuvers that they do. But I think it's easily explainable. Anyone who travels to another country pays attention to the exchange rate. You want to know how well the dollar is going to do if you're traveling to Europe or Canada or Mexico, and you're hoping for a strong dollar because it means you're going to be able to buy more when you're overseas. Now, what China does when it comes to trade, and trade is good in goods, it wants to keep its currency rate as low as it possibly can against the dollar. And usually exchange rates are set by the market. That is, if one economy is stronger and growing, its exchange rate will improve and will appreciate versus another economy, especially if that economy is not growing. What the Chinese are doing is intervening. Their currency should be worth much more than it is based on the size of their economy, based on their growth and productivity. But they've held it pegged to the U.S. dollar at about 6.8 yuan, which is their currency, to a dollar for the last 2.5 years. And before that, it was pegged from about 2001 and 2005. And the reason they do that is it gives their exporters a price advantage. It also makes U.S. exports going into China much more expensive than they otherwise should be. And most economists, and these are actually very free trade economists, estimate that the currency in China is overvalued by about, undervalued by about 40%. So it's essentially a 40% tax on U.S. goods going into China. And it's essentially a 40% artificial discount that Chinese producers get on goods that are coming into the United States. Now, it may seem great when you're at the store and you can see a T-shirt from China that costs $5, but we end up paying for that elsewhere in the economy. And we've certainly paid for it as a country because we've lost these manufacturing jobs and they simply haven't been replaced by anything else.
So to take the devil's advocate role in this, what I'm hearing is that they are discounting their goods to us at 40%. We're paying 40% less when you go to, you know, one of these big box stores for products that are made in China. If they didn't manipulate their currency, then we'd have essentially 40% inflation on most of those goods.
I don't think that we would see that, and actually most economists who look at that don't see it that way either. The reason being, you know, twofold. Number one, retailers, especially kind of the big box retailers, are so price sensitive that they would not be marking up their products by 40%. So that's answer number one. Answer number two is that some of that Chinese production would be absorbed in the United States, and some of it would be absorbed elsewhere. From the world, and we'd still be importing products, obviously, and there'd still be competition, and that would keep prices low. But what it does mean is that for a lot of goods, and I'm talking about things that people don't buy, but like printed circuit boards, semiconductors, a lot of high-tech equipment that go into the guts of manufacturing, we could be making a lot of that in the United States rather than in China. And that would have great benefits for communities all across the country that have been hollowed out because they've lost a lot of these manufacturing jobs.
And I guess the way to look at that might be that while there is this discount, the discount went away. I mean, people always talk about fair trade, free trade, that sort of thing. If everybody has a level playing field, which that would then create a real level playing field, unlike the NAFTA kind of things that gave them a level playing field and not us. This would be a situation where we could make things here and it'd be price competitive, and you'd have real competition to bring the prices actually down.
I think that's exactly right. Now, I don't want to delude people into believing that that we're going to bring T-shirt production back to the United States wholesale. I mean, you know, we may bring some, but especially for very labor-intensive industries, there is enough of a labor rate differential that you're not going to bring that back wholesale. But there are other parts of manufacturing, and that's the high-tech manufacturing, that's energy-intensive manufacturing, where we can be very competitive because we're much more efficient producers than the Chinese are. And the only reason that the Chinese are able to compete is because they have this currency subsidy and other sorts of subsidies that are provided to them by the Chinese government. So if you erase that and you give us a level playing field, you'll see more manufacturing jobs, you'll see manufacturing incomes rise, and that's going to benefit entire communities, whether you work in a factory or not.
So how do we get there? I mean, it sounds like if the Chinese government's doing this themselves, what leverage do we have to force them on this?
Well, traditionally, governments that are engaging in this sort of manipulation are not going to change their behavior on their own because it's obviously advantaging them. And it usually takes someone else coming in and intervening and saying you have to stop or there are going to be consequences. That's happened a couple of times. Ronald Reagan did it with the Japanese in the 1980s and brought the value of the yen up versus the dollar. We actually balanced our overall trade checkbook in that decade, for the first time in a long time. Richard Nixon did this in 1971 with West Germany and Japan. Did something very similar. And so I'm also showing that this is not a partisan issue or something that just labor unions care about. As I'm talking about Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan here. But what Obama has tried to do right now is talk to the Chinese about it. They haven't budged. It's going to take a real strong message from Congress to China that, look, there are going to be penalties unless you start to change this behavior in order for this to get resolved. I'm pretty confident of that. And so, you know, the clock is running down on the congressional session, and we may well see some action before they gavel out for the year.
Now, people are always concerned whenever you talk about trade that there'll be a trade war. What exactly are the likelihood of something like that happening, and what would it mean as we come into our last minute?
You know, the trade war boogeyman is brought up a lot. I mean, when we did Buy America rules for the stimulus, the same fear was out there, and it didn't result in any trade war. This would not result in a trade war for the very simple reason that Chinese employment and manufacturing depends on access to the U.S. market. One third of the goods that they manufacture end up in the American market. They don't have a substitute for that. They can't absorb that domestically. They can't sell it anywhere else. They need the American consumer market, which is, you know, which is only 5% of the world's population, but is the richest in the world, to absorb that. They're not going to do anything that's going to threaten that. It's what I would call mutually assured destruction. They're not going to start a trade war, and we're just standing up for our rights, and we're countering some very mercantilist and protectionist things that China's doing already.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Scott Paul, the Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. So we were talking about the possibility that there might be a trade war with China and what that means and the likelihood that it probably wouldn't happen just because we're so sort of codependent upon each other's economies. Is that right?
I think that's right. There is it's really a kind of a last ditch, desperate Hail Mary argument that's made when the other side, that's kind of for the status quo, thinks that that's being threatened. But the reality is, there's not going to be a trade war under the rules we have today. And what any action the United States would take would be completely compliant with our trade obligations. We'd merely be responding to a very protectionist policy that China has. That I would say, by the way, it not only hurts the United States, it hurts any other industrialized country that's competing in our market or in other markets. So Brazil, India, South Africa, the Europeans, they're all disadvantaged by Chinese currency manipulation as well. So in that regard, I don't think we have a fear. Now, other people raise this debt issue. We owe a lot of debt to China. China buys T-bills, and they buy other forms of U.S. debt, and they help to finance our debt. And so some will say, well, we can't do, you know, we can't take on China because they're our banker. And yes, they do hold some U.S. assets. They've actually diminished them slightly. There are a lot of other countries that hold U.S. assets, like Japan. I don't think that it diminishes our access at all. In fact, there are a lot of buyers for U.S. debt, both domestically and on the international market. We never have a problem selling T-bills or securities or anything that we need to do to finance. The Chinese choose to buy our debt. And the reason why they choose to buy our debt is because they want to buy up dollars and get their currency out there on the market to make it worth less. It goes back to this currency manipulation. And so the whole irony of this, if we bring down our trade deficit, we'll bring down our budget deficit, we'll bring down our dependence on China for debt. And the way we have to do that is through stopping China's currency manipulation. The other thing, and Paul Krugman, who's a well-known, highly regarded economist, Nobel Prize laureate, has said, you know, when you owe a country that much money, really, who has the leverage? I mean, you know, if you default on it, you're really going to screw them and put them over a barrel. So it's not really China who has the leverage. It's certainly the United States in this case that can call a lot of the shots.
So in some ways, I guess you're saying we're too big to fail.
That's yes. I hate to use the financial the Wall Street analogy to that, but in a lot of ways, I think that's entirely true.
Well, let's shift gears a minute and talk about things that we can do domestically. What are some of your thoughts on President Obama's recent announcement for a planned infrastructure initiative?
Oh, I think it's great, and we need more of it. I mean, there's a couple of reasons. First, we get a D on our infrastructure report card from the American Society of Civil Engineers. It means our roads, our bridges, our ports, our rails, our sewer systems are in dilapidated condition. Sometimes they're more than 100 years old. You see that not only in your everyday life commuting around, but you see the toll it takes on our economy, because we're constantly trying to fix and patch holes rather than to invest in the future. So I think it does make a great deal of sense to invest heavily in infrastructure. There's a great return to taxpayers on that sort of investment. It creates construction jobs. It creates demand for manufactured materials. You're going to bring our infrastructure report card up, which we desperately need to do if we're going to be competitive in the global marketplace. It's going to make our economy more efficient, and it's going to help with regard to environmental goals as well. So it is precisely the kind of investment that we should be making, and we can make that both through a direct investment, and there's a proposal that Congressman Oberstar from Minnesota has to do a $500 billion infrastructure investment that would be paid for by gas taxes. The other piece of this is an infrastructure bank, and the president has talked about that in his proposal as well. And it's also a great idea because it would finance large projects of public significance, things like high-speed rail that cost a lot of money when you're just even building one segment of high-speed rail. And it simply provides federal loan guarantees for private capital that would be involved with this. And so it would help to leverage that private capital And it's another great kind of long-term funding solution to do infrastructure. Every year that we don't do this, the bill only grows. I mean, the road doesn't get any better. The bridge doesn't rebuild itself. And every year that goes by, it's going to cost more to do that. So anything that we defer to the future, it's actually going to be worse off for our kids and our grandkids.
And, you know, as you mentioned that, when people talk about infrastructure, it tends to get the donut eye glaze. You know, it may seem like a boring policy topic to some people, but when you think about something like rail, for instance, and increasing capacity on our rail lines, increasing the ability to have high-speed rail and things like that, it really has huge payoffs for the general public and also for business. Isn't that right?
Oh, very much so. I mean, and that's why this is one of those issues where you find agreement between labor and business and constructors and a lot of economists as well, who think that we need this kind of capital spending. And there's the only thing standing in the way, honestly, is that it is I think it's very difficult, especially for some members of the Republican Party now, to support gas tax increases. And even though a lot of polling shows that people are willing to pay for improvements that are going directly into their roads and bridges and what have you, that there's a lot of support for doing that. And so I think in a lot of ways, politics gets in the ways of this and kind of this obsession with debt and taxes when all the polling shows that people want good roads, they want good bridges, they want their sewers to be 21st century, they want a smart electrical grid, they want access to better rail transportation. People want this, and they're willing to pay for it. And the only thing that we're lacking right now is some of the political will to do that, especially, unfortunately, by the Republican Party.
And really, when you think about something like a gas tax, isn't it really more of a user fee? I mean, as you think about things, I mean, if you don't drive a lot of miles, you're not going to be paying a lot in taxes.
That's exactly right. It's totally a user fee. And, you know, there are always these quibbles about formulas and who gets what and what kind of fuel is taxed. But those usually get worked out in the end. I mean, my big concern is that this we used to have this grand coalition on infrastructure, and it's gradually kind of eroded away because the extremists in one party are just saying no to everything. And we need to say you got to be able to say yes to infrastructure. Otherwise, you're going to get a flat tire on the way home, but you're going to give our economy a flat tire too because we're going to be falling behind. If you go to this is, I think, a great example. Anyone who's ever been to China and has seen the Shanghai airport and then taken the high-speed rail at about 250 miles an hour from the airport to downtown thinks you're in a first-world country, at least when you're doing that. You go to JFK or something like that, you think exactly the opposite. And you wonder, who is who? And I'm not saying this because we should be embarrassed about JFK, but what I am saying is that we have not made the investments that other countries have into making their infrastructure much more competitive. That's both to their advantage and it's to our disadvantage. We're shooting ourselves in the foot by not making these investments now.
And you bring out an excellent point in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. It certainly seems like everybody knows the cost of a lot of things, but they don't actually know the benefits of some things. And you mentioned cars on the road. If the roads aren't paved and kept up to date, how many times do you need to pay for a front end alignment? And if you do that times, all the cars on the road versus an extra penny on the gas tax, I mean, doesn't it seem more efficient economically to fix the road than to keep fixing the car every day?
Not only the car, because that's a good point, but also just the time that we spend commuting. And the time that we aren't working or spending with our families, and then that also leads to increased pollution. So, I mean, the benefits of infrastructure investment are enormous. And just on the manufacturing side, you look at the amount of steel that goes into bridges, that goes into rails. It's a huge market potentially for our steel makers. And we desperately need a boost for manufacturing. The construction workers can certainly use the work because unemployment in some states for construction workers is well above 20%. So it's a huge need. And again, we make an initial investment. We get it back. The return to taxpayers on this is very good.
Now, you know, I remember in the 80s, people were talking about industrial policy. There was a movement towards having something to kind of look at this. As we talk about America's manufacturing strategy today, how would you evaluate what we need to do, what's working, what's strong, what's not?
Well, the manufacturing strategy debate is a very important one to have, and it's one that we have deferred, in fact, for about 30 years in a lot of ways. We haven't had a serious discussion about what the appropriate role for government is in kind of boosting our manufacturing sector. We've substituted that with a policy of outsourcing and basically saying we'd love for our manufacturers to make profits. We don't care where they make any of their goods. And the net result of that has been a lot of offshoring of work. But what I think even people at places like the Harvard Business School are discovering is that not only the work is going overseas, but the innovation is going overseas. And even if we wanted to make a laptop in this country, we would have to completely rebuild an infrastructure to do that. Or a cell phone in this country, we'd have to completely rebuild an infrastructure to do that. Even though we invented the solar panel and the wind turbine in the 1970s, we had to literally rebuild our capacity to make these things from the ground up. And we're playing catch up with the rest of the world precisely because we didn't value where things were made. Now, this does not mean that the federal government becomes a factory manager. Let me make that very clear. But it does mean that we get federal policies on the side of making things in the United States. So we have better tax policies that promote domestic production so that we have long-term investments that we can make. We know there's going to be a market here. A great example is clean energy technology or infrastructure, as we were talking about. And we desperately need to both on the blue collar production line level, as well as the scientific level, greatly improve the skills training and education programs that we offer for the productive sector of the economy. We've lost a lot of that. And all the evidence shows that you need a public private academic partnership, both to spur the next big innovation and also to make it here. And we have schools now that are not focused on vocational education or technical education. And, you know, they're focused on testing, and that's a completely separate debate. But the challenge is that young people now are ill-prepared to enter the productive workforce. And so if a steel plant is hiring, it's hard to find people who have the skills. Or if a wind turbine manufacturer is hiring, it's hard to have it's hard to find people who have those skills precisely because we've kind of given up on that. I like the president's focus on it. I think it's very important. I like the fact that the Congress has started to focus on this. Now we need to achieve some results because we got the debate started.
And that, as we come into our last minute, I mean, that's really the results piece of this thing. I know when the inauguration was going on, everybody was talking about green jobs, green jobs, green jobs. And we know we need jobs, and we know we need to find alternative energy sources. I mean, none of this stuff is new. None of this stuff is rocket science, I guess. What's going on? Why aren't these things being built in America?
Well, it's precisely because other countries have an industrial policy and we don't. Germany is not a sunny place. It's not a particularly windy place, but it's a world leader in both solar production and wind turbine production precisely because they have policies to help production in Germany, and we don't. So it's as fundamental as that. It's not wage competition because, I mean, yes, we're competing against China, but we can outproduce them in a lot of different ways. I mean, if we're competing against Germany, we're competing against higher wages. So it's not our labor rates that matter. It's the fact that we really haven't focused federal attention on ways to make manufacturing competitive, all the way from technology to skills to the right tax policies. We have to piece that together, and we need to do it in a hurry.
I want to say thank you to our guests this week, Congresswoman Donna Edwards, NAACP President and CEO Ben Jealous, and Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.